I'm glad that you came here to talk about cutting for stone. And I always like to start with a little question so that I can get to know your names a little bit and know a little bit about you, but I need someone to be a recorder on the whiteboard, okay?
I've been avoiding that all the time.
So what color shall I choose?
Ooh,
see? All fancy. If you could please give your first name, and then I would like to hear a book that you just couldn't finish. So I have true confessions. My name is Jan, and I could not finish Lord of the Rings. My children are very ashamed of me. They hold it against me, but I couldn't. So, Jan, Lord of the Rings, right there it is up in print and everything, all to see. Norma, how about you?
My name is Norma, and I had a terrible time with a book that was very similar to Lord of the Rings, and I'm thinking it was like Wind in the Willows or something, and I don't think it was that.
It's not that tough.
Well, that tells you something.
But I also could not finish Lord of the Rings. There was just something about it that I tried. The first time I tried to read Catcher in the Rye, I could not. So it was with Catcher in the Rye.
All right.
I read it again many years later, and I was like, oh, this is what they're trying to say.
It's all timing.
Yeah.
It's really so often about timing.
So if you think about it, I can come up with those, but I.
Okay, we are giving our name and a name of a book we couldn't finish. A book we just were not able to finish.
That we didn't like?
I'm not saying that. They just couldn't finish for whatever reason. So let's go on to you.
I'm Sue. I have lots of books that I haven't finished that I can't remember them now, but I just finished reading one that I forced myself to finish.
Oh, let's hear that.
And that was Trinity.
By Leanne Orris?
Right.
Okay.
And I just said, you've got to finish this. And I finished it last week. I'm so excited.
Hey, you never have to read it again.
I'm Karen. And I did make it through The Lord of the Rings, the first book, but the second book, what is that? The Two Towers? That is when I stopped.
Uh-huh.
And so my whole family just loves the whole trilogy and all of the other books. And I just...
Well, we could.
The movies were great.
Yeah, I did like the movies, but I could just. Okay. Are you ready?
Kristen? I'm going to spell it wrong.
It's with a K.
And
I'm a compulsive Ian, but I made myself finish another story.
Okay.
I suppose the one that I just really struggled through was Pannenberg's Ethics. I can't even remember the
Ethics?
Yeah, it was an ethics, it was an academic thing that I made myself do.
Okay. That sounds like something I'd have to make myself read too. Okay, ladies in the back row, or you can warm up here.
Hey, well, are you ready? Question. I started saying.
Okay, the question is, we would like to know your name and then the title of a book that you just couldn't finish.
My name is Gwen. I can't think of a book I couldn't finish, but you do. Did you talk about Nancy Pearl's opinion on that? You read the number of pages of your age, and if you can't get into the book, then.
I love Nancy Pearl. Yeah, book lust. A librarian, my role model. All right, are you ready to go?
Well, probably as ready as I'll ever be, because I can't recall one. Well, my name's Haley.
Okay.
And I think I would say Colors of the Earth. I rented the movie and said. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was it?
Pillars of the Earth.
Everyone says that.
It's all right. No judgment here. No judgment.
For what it's worth, the HBO miniseries of Pillars of the Earth is pretty good too.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
But I did like the book. But you know, that's one I listened to as an audiobook.
Okay.
And I think there's something
about. I can get through
about
a lot of books on audio that I would never make it through reading.
No.
Does that count?
Absolutely.
It does?
Oh, yeah. Oh. How do you think I read this the first time?
I don't know.
It was 2 months of driving to work and back.
Okay.
It's like, then I'd be in the driveway like, I should go in now, but I just want to try this. Driveway
moment. I call them on NPR.
They're not short off.
Yeah, yeah, just make sure. Got the engine running. Hey, how about you?
The book I'm listening to on tape right now, I tried to read several times and didn't get past the first third, but Moby Dick.
Oh, I should have put that on there. I've tried reading that and listening to it, and
we're doing fine coming from California
good.
Back.
You are, I good for you.
Okay, didn't get a name though.
Hey.
What do you hey.
Okay.
Okay. Who's next?
I'm Carol. And my kids really thought I should read the Harry Potter series. I made it to the first one.
They just stopped. Well, you've done what you set out to do.
They kept naming what?
Yeah. All
I'm
right.
Sarah, and S-A-R-A-H. And there's several for book club, but I can't remember the titles because it's too much. But I do the 50-page turn. You know, oh, I'm going to turn 50 pages, read. Sometimes it grabs me and I get into it again, and other times I just do another 50 pages until I get to the end.
It's a novel idea. I've never heard of that one.
And usually I don't have to go back and find. Sometimes you have to go back and figure out, oh, what passage do you need to know?
So you just kind of keep plowing ahead. You jump ahead 50 pages?
I read 2 or 3 pages, 50 pages, 2 or 3. Turn.
I think you should try that with Moby Dick, because I got so bogged down on how to build the stupid ship or whatever that was.
I changed my War and Peace. I've tried War and Peace. I've tried to map all the characters. I can't keep them straight.
They only have about 12 names, those Russian novels. They all have an ending.
Were you sure you were Colors, right?
Mine was Ethics.
Ethics. Okay.
Oh, and I remember Brothers K was in that. Read 50 pages and I when I got up to 150, I still got 100.
Yeah,
Brothers Karamazov.
No,
or no, Brothers K.
Brothers K.
Okay, we need to pick up a couple of people.
Okay, I'm Candy on the back row.
Okay.
I'm coming. I know.
I know. I'm
Candy. Coming. What's your book that you weren't able to finish?
One of the last of the series of the Jan Grun series.
Yeah.
I got really irritated with
them. They got weaker, didn't they?
They
were so Mitford at home in Mitford.
Yeah.
Lovely at the beginning, but
the ending
she
one.
Was milking.
Yeah,
absolutely nothing.
And I got really irritated with that series. But I am a front book, end book, then middle of the book reader quite often. I read and get bored in the front. I have to say if it really is gone where I'm predicting it will go. And then I have to go catch up on those threads.
Okay.
You know, if you there's something that didn't quite make sense, it may be, it may not be the overall storyline, but there'll be one piece that.
I'm too linear. I don't think I could do that.
Well, it drives my book club. And, you know, and the question is, when Candy, did you read from front to back? A good book, and I believe Candy from Stone I read from front to back.
Mm-hmm.
It's a front to back book. But the boring books are front and looking at where that thread come in that I didn't predict correctly for the rest of the time.
Very good. That's very interesting. Okay, we need to catch up on a couple other people here.
Barbara.
Yeah, back with that part of
and Middlesex.
Oh, or Jeffrey,
no,
Janity.
It's the one.
Middlemarch?
Middlemarch.
Oh, Middlemarch.
George Eliot?
No.
Middlemarch, okay. Considered the first great modern novel, which I have not read, so.
Carolyn Kennedy said it was her favorite, and one of Jacqueline Kennedy's favorite books. So that's why I thought I should read it. Mm-hmm. That's what they saw.
Okay, Sicily, Alaska, I love your t-shirt.
Oh, thank you. Love the series.
I love the series, too. Great show.
Molly. And as Corinne said, told by the Nance and Pearl. And there have been a number of books over the last year that are less than read my age, and decided to put them down. And interestingly enough, because of my age, I can't remember the title.
How
it
all works out.
I don't know.
it all works out.
Yeah.
Well, that's all right. If you think of one later, just shout it out.
Fair enough.
Barbara?
I was just going to say, I did just try and read 50 Shades of Grey.
Have you read that?
Yeah. Yep.
That is really not my cup of tea.
So not worth. Not worth hiding it.
No, you need to page through it at Costco.
Or you don't know anyone.
Yeah.
Glenn, how about you?
I'm a big fan of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, but the book, the prequel to it, is called The Silmarillion, and that one hung me up. I could not finish that, because it was trying to set and give historical detail to The Hobbit and these, you know, kingdoms and families, and woo, The Silmarillion. No story.
Prequel to The Hobbit.
Very good.
Yeah, prequel to The Hobbit.
I don't know how to spell.
Yeah, have we gotten yours, John?
I couldn't think of my good memory title.
And tell your name.
Kathleen.
All right, well, this is very interesting. So, you know, you can make this as a list if you want or not. And I think it just brings you back to, there are certain times in your life when a book means a lot, and other times where it just doesn't resonate. There are books that you, your best friend in the world might love, and that you just don't, and that is absolutely okay. And I think that's kind of Nancy Pearl, who really is my role model. She's the superhero librarian. There's an action figure with shushing action.
Oh,
yeah. She's fantastic. Yeah. And she's written a book called Book Lust, and then Book Lust 2, and she talks about how to choose books. She's a genius at listening to what people have liked in the past, what it was they liked about it, and then making recommendations. So she's at Seattle Public Library. Fabulous. So tonight we're going to talk about Cutting for Stone. Many of you have read it, some have not, and that's A-okay. And this is one that I listened to. Pardon? The author is Abraham Verghese, V-E-R-G-H-E-S-E. He was born and raised in Ethiopia, but he is of Indian descent, and he was educated in the United States. He is a physician. He is a surgeon. And so I've talked to a few people that didn't like this book because it was too medical. It was too bloody. It's very vivid. I mean, there's some pretty vivid descriptions of surgery, I think. But he is a doctor by training, and I believe still practices. He's at Stanford. Let me take a look here. Yeah. So, you know, he's kind of stupid, too. He's a professor and senior associate chair for the theory and practice of medicine at Stanford School of Medicine. He's a founding director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio. He's now an adjunct professor. And then he's written a couple of other books. My Own Country, the Time Best Book of the Year in 1994. The Tennis Partner, a New York Times notable book. And a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. And he's published essays and short stories that have also appeared. So anyway, that's the title that we're talking about. So just to sort of refresh your memory, if it's been a little while, this is a book that is set in Ethiopia in the 1950s, and it kind of goes through time, and it goes India, Ethiopia, as well as the United States. The main characters, just to start off with, are Sister Mary Joseph Praise. Anybody remember anything about Sister's story, what it is that she does, or how it is that she's in the story?
Does she come from India?
She comes from India. What is her training? What does she do for a
nurse?
She's a nurse, right. She's been trained in India. And it's very prestigious for her to have been selected to be a nurse. And she and another nurse leave India the day that they graduate from nursing school. They're going to go to, not to Ethiopia, but to Yemen, because there's a Catholic hospital there. They're going to go to Yemen. And then they're going to be Sisters of Charity there. They're going to practice nursing there. So, anybody remember what happens in the ship voyage over?
She
meets Thomas Stone, who is a physician. He's British, and he's been training in India. And her companion dies. Yeah, she contracts a fever. They have to be quarantined. Thomas Stone also has this fever, but he does recover partly because of the nursing care that she gives him. And then her companion dies. Then they debark. Thomas Stone is already headed off to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, but the sister ends up staying in Yemen, which is where she was assigned to go. That's where Mother Superior said, this is where you need to go. We don't know what happens in Yemen, really. Something terrible happens. a year later, she shows up at the hospital in Addis Ababa, right? So that's kind of the setting. It's always called Missing Hospital. It's actually Mission Hospital, but in Ethiopian language, it sounds like Missing. So everybody just talks about Missing. I'm going to Missing. So then what happens? Sister Mary Joseph Praise becomes the surgical assistant to a brilliant surgeon, Thomas Stone. So what are his issues? What's going on with him when we first meet him? What do we know about him? Would you want to invite him over for dinner? Would you like to, you know, go for a walk with him?
Yeah, so his mother was died of tuberculosis, and he was used to serve his father. His father was older, and he died. Mm-hmm.
He's like a binge alcoholic.
Yeah, he's a binge alcoholic.
He doesn't have many social skills. He's
No. Kind of barks at people, and doesn't have a lot of social
skills. He writes basically in boarding schools.
Yeah.
And by people who had really nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I don't think he had any sort of loving relationship with people. Yeah, at all. Extremely bright. Huh?
His mom before she passed away.
Yeah, his mom before.
Tender and kind of symbiotic relationship.
Then also, he's brilliant. He went to Scotland. He, you know, trained there at the College of Surgeons there. He was so committed to becoming an excellent surgeon that he bought his own cadaver. You know, in anatomy class, he shared a cadaver, but he wanted his own cadaver so that he could really, you know, really be the best. And that's all he did was medicine. All he did was medicine. He later goes on to write a surgical handbook that's considered kind of the gold standard of tropical medicine. You know, he has all these little witticisms like, what is the one medicine that the doctor can administer by ear? Words of comfort. You know, so he has all these little things that he says like that that become quite famous. So the sister shows up. They have about 7 years where she is his surgical assistant, and they're kind of like one person. He doesn't ever have to ask for an instrument. He never has to ask for suction. I mean, she does everything. She's just, you know, right there back and forth. What's one thing that's really interesting about Thomas Stone that happens to him while he's doing surgery?
He gets his finger punctured by a stray needle that gets infected, and he has to amputate his own finger.
Yeah.
So, and he amputates it all the way down so that his middle finger kind of moves over, and then he has just 4 digits on the hand that people don't notice because he's so adept at that.
Yeah, and he actually prefers it in some ways because he's able to get his hand into places where he wouldn't have been able to otherwise. So, yeah, from the knuckle up.
Did he
do it
during an operation?
Or just... No, he you know, like, gave himself a shot of antibiotics right off the bat, and it took a little while, but he didn't have Gosh or one of the other doctors do it for him. He did it himself. Sister assisted him. So it's like, okay, there you get, in a nutshell, the guy that amputates his own finger is not your average Joe, really.
Well, it's not clear. In the years.
This is in the 50s, 1950s.
It's not clear why he does that. Like, if he doesn't trust the other doctors to do it. It just isn't clear, I don't think.
No, but that would be my guess. Wouldn't it be for you?
I think he'd probably be embarrassed because it was an indication of a bad move in the OR.
Could be. And it was, you know, conditions there. It was a hospital. They had electricity. They had, you know, sterilization, all that. But it was, you know, not as advanced as a Western hospital. So there were things that they had to kind of make do with.
And he was a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted the guy just so that he didn't
get anesthesia.
He wasn't available to see
what
they were doing, if they were doing it correctly.
I think that's very true. He was. Who else would he trust as a surgeon? Let's just talk a little bit about these other characters, and then we're going to do a little background on Ethiopia. Okay, so we'll leave Marianne and Shiva for now. Some of the main characters that work or live at Missing are Hema, who is a woman from India, who is an obstetrician, and she has a very dramatic entrance in the novel. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Gosh, who is also from India, so they are both sort of... not exiled, but they both left. They're both expats. They both live in a country that is not their own. Janet is a friend of the boys as they grow up. We'll be talking about her later. Matron. Anybody remember who Matron was? I'm sure she has a name. She's always referred to as Matron because she's the head nurse. She's also a nun. So she and Sister Mary are really the only two Catholic nuns at this hospital. It's become just a hospital. I mean, it's just they take money from Baptists and people, you know, Episcopalians, anybody, because they're trying to, you know, kind of be on the front end of things. And then the probationer is pretty memorable. She's a nursing student. They're called probation. They're on probation when they're not nurses yet. And she's, you know, you've probably all known people in your life that are smart but just have no common sense. And the probationer pretty much fits that all the way through. She just doesn't understand people, has no nursing sense, is what Matron says. She's just not able to go with that. Just to get a little bit of background, though, on what was going on in Ethiopia at the time, this is a pretty quick introduction, but is anybody willing to be a reader here? Okay. I'll get you later. You would just start here and then on to the next page.
You could say the probationer's sense presence at missing was an accident of history. Her hometown of Asmara was the capital city of Eritrea, a country that had been an Italian colony from as far back as 1885. The Italians under Mussolini invaded Ethiopia from Eritrea in 1935, the world powers were willing to intercede. When Mussolini threw his lot in with Hitler, his fate was sealed, and in 1941, Colonel Wingate Gideon Force had defeated the Italians and liberated Ethiopia. The Allies gave Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia a most unusual gift. They tacked on a very old Italian colony of Eritrea as a protectorate of newly liberated Ethiopia. The emperor had lobbied hard for just this, so that his landlocked country could have the support of Massawa, not to mention the lovely city of Asmara. The British perhaps wanted to punish the Eritreans for their long collaboration with the Italians. Eritrean Ashkarish, thousands of them, were part of the Italian army and had fought their black neighbors and died alongside their white masters. For the Eritreans to have their land handed to Ethiopia was an unimaginable wound, akin to giving liberated France to England, merely because the people of both countries were white and ate cabbage. When a few years later the emperor annexed the land, the Eritreans at once began a guerrilla war for their liberation.
Thank you. Is that kind of where I marked it at? Okay. So what little I know about Ethiopia, you know, I learned most things from books. From novels. So what little I know about Ethiopia at that point, that kind of summarizes it. It was a British colony. It was an Italian colony. There were still a lot of leftovers from the days of Italy. There's cappuccinos. There's, you know, Campari umbrellas. There's, you know, there's still a kind of an Italian feeling to Addis Ababa in particular. And then at about the time of the novel, Haile Selassie comes into power. And then there's this whole side issue with Eritrea, and that's one of the characters, Janet, is that is her ethnicity. So it's one of those things where, you know, I guess another example where I know so little about that part of the world, and I know so little about those ethnic differences or why people are, you know, fighting each other. So you get a little bit of insight reading a book like this, but I'm certainly no expert on that part of the world at all. So I wish that I had Stephen here to fill this in, but. Anybody else have any more familiarity with Ethiopia at that time? Were you raising your hand?
I came in a little bit late.
Yeah.
What's the time
period? It's in the 1950s and 60s. And it's the book covers a part where Haile Selassie does come into power. He's emperor of Ethiopia. Okay. Well, we might be getting to that because the book does continue.
Can give you
a little quick
example.
Yeah, let's hear it. Well, and there are people that believe, that, isn't it, Rastafarians that
yes.
believe in the kind of the embodiment of Haile Selassie
right.
as the savior.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a whole different deal.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's get to the meat of this story. A lot of things happen at the beginning of this novel. For example, a nun goes into labor, and no one knows that she's pregnant. A nun goes into labor with twins, and nobody knows that she's pregnant. A nun who is always with Thomas Stone appears to be pregnant because of Thomas Stone. But all of this happens as a medical crisis ensues. I mean, she is in very, very, very bad trouble. And no one really, the probationer is sent to ask how she is, and then because according to the rules, she didn't really think that anybody would care that the sister didn't wake when she went in to see her, then she doesn't tell anyone. So the probationer feels a lot of guilt about that, that she doesn't really follow up, she didn't really know, no one told her that she should report back that sister was as sick as she was. At this time also, Hema, who is an obstetrician, is gone. She's gone back to India to visit her parents, which she does every 3 or 4 years, and they are pressuring her very much to get married. She's a Brahmin, so she's top caste. And Ghosh is also Indian, and they've been friendly, and she's kind of started to think about him, but he's not Brahmin, so of course her parents object to that a lot. And in the midst of this medical crisis, this horrible medical crisis, Hema, the one person who could be of some help, is gone. So let's go to, anybody want to be a reader here? This is the portion. This is your portion. You're sitting too close to my husband. I don't want to look up that way. So this is the part where Hema has been on leave in India, and she is on her way back to missing, not knowing that all hell is broken loose. So this is just to give you an idea of her character.
What a specimen Hema thought as she studied him.
Oh, I'm sorry. Laura, let me just give a little thing. She's been on a plane that's flying with a cargo plane, basically, and this pilot has on purpose almost crashed the plane because he needed to make an emergency landing to pick up supplies. And so a little boy was thrown over and broke his leg. People are screaming, praying. You know, they think they're going down because one of the propellers is down. Well, now they've landed safely, and the pilot just thinks it's kind of a big joke. Okay, go ahead.
What a specimen Hema thought as she studied him. Spider angiomas all over his exposed skin, eyes tinged with jaundice. No doubt his breasts are enlarged, his armpits hairless, and his testes shriveled to the size of walnuts, all because his liver no longer detoxifies the estrogen a male normally produces. And the stale juniper berry breath, ah yes, she thought, coming to a diagnosis beyond cirrhosis. A gin-soaked colonial resisting the reality of post-colonial Africa. If in India they are still cowed by all of you, it is from long habit. But there are no such rules on an Ethiopian plane. She felt her rage boil over, and it was directed not just at him, but at all men. Every man who in the government general hospital in India had pushed her around, taken her for granted, punished her for being a woman, played with her hours and her schedule, transferred her here and there without so much as a please or a by your leave. Her proximity to him, her encroachment of sacred Bwana space, rattled him, distracted him. But his hand was still up there. And now, if he just noticed it, if he moved the hand, not to strike her, he would claim, but as if to determine whether it really was his hand, and to see if it still answered to his commands. The upraised hand was insult enough, but when Hema saw it started to move, she reacted in a manner that made her blush when she recalled it later. Hema laid his fingers shot up the pilot's shorts and locked around his testicles, only his underwear intervening. There was an ease to her movements which surprised her, and an ease to the way the gap between her thumbs and index fingers allowed passage for the spermatic cords that connected balls to the body. Years later, she would think that what she did was conditioned by her surroundings, by the propensity in East Africa for shiftas and other criminals to lop off their victims' testicles. When in Rome... Her eyes burned like a martyr's. Sweat changed the patu on her forehead from a dot to an exclamation point. Is that how you say that? The patu? Her eyes burned like a martyr. Sweat changed the patu on her forehead from a dot to an exclamation mark. She had worn a cotton sari for the heat, and earlier when she'd been seated, she had hiked it to her knees, modesty be damned. And now that she was standing, it stayed that way, outlining her thighs.
Sweat glistened on her upper lip as she squeezed to extract the same measure of distress and fear the Frenchman had caused her. "Listen, sweetie," she said, deciding that there was indeed testicular atrophy, and also trying to recall tunica albuginae and tunica something else, and vos deferens, of course, and that craggy thing at the back, what's it called, epididymis. She saw his shoulder sag and the color drain out of his face as if she'd opened a spigot below. Dampness quite different from sweat appeared on his forehead. "At least your syphilis isn't far advanced, because you can feel testicular pain, eh?" His upraised hand came floating down and then hesitantly, almost lovingly, rested on her forearm, pleading with her not to increase the pressure. A cathedral of silence descended on the plane. "Are you listening now?" she said, thinking that she didn't really want to know a man's anatomy this way. "Are we talking as equals? My life in your hands and now your family jewels in mine? You think you can terrify people like that? That little boy broke his leg because of your stunt." She turned her head towards the other passengers, but keeping her eye on Frenchie's face, she said, "Anybody have a sharp knife? Or a Gillette?"
Hema was at the end of her rope. She was flying back from India where her parents are pestering her to get married. She's just had it. She's just had it. It's a, you know, as a woman in the 1950s, even as a well-trained physician, she's never going to be able to advance in India, and which is why she ends up staying in Ethiopia. Her work is so needed, and she's able to continue with that. So, what happens when Hema does walk into the operating room? What all has transpired in those few hours? Sister Mary is
hemorrhaging to death.
Yeah, she's hemorrhaging to death. And Thomas Stone, is useless, worse than useless, absolutely frozen. I mean, this brilliant surgeon is so stunned and so, he's immobilized. He's absolutely immobilized. So Hema kind of arrives in the nick of time, but a great deal of blood has been lost. The thing I like about Borghese's writing, too, is he always describes a lot of visual images, but also things like smells and sounds, and, you know, he really evokes the setting, I think, so very well. Hema gets in there, she pushes Stone aside, she starts to deliver the babies and realizes she needs to do a cesarean, which, of course, he would be qualified, more than qualified to do. And do you remember, there's one other very gruesome detail that she stops him from doing. It was a gruesome detail I had forgotten.
The baby was trying to come.
He was going to crush the... He didn't know there were two. He was going to crush the skull of one to deliver it vaginally.
And that plays throughout the book.
And so when Hema comes, she does a C-section like that. You know, she get, you know, all this, you know, horror is going on, all this blood, all this terrible. And then that's when they realize that they're not only are they twins, but they're conjoined twins, and they're kind of joined at the forehead. And they, of course, don't know if they will be able to separate them, if they'll survive any of that. They do ultimately. It's a fairly simple procedure to separate them, and they do survive. But Sister Mary, of course, is going downhill. So I've got another reading. Anybody else want to read something for me? Okay, great. So this is Thomas's reaction after the twins have been delivered.
He pushed the breast up and out of the way, and under his knife a red gash appeared between the fourth and fifth ribs. He drew the knife over the wound again and yet again till he was through muscle. If he was clumsy earlier, his movements now were those of a man incapable of tentative strokes. He cut the cartilages that connected the two ribs to the breastbone. He spread the ribs and watched in disbelief as his ungloved hand slid out of sight and into the still warm cavity of her chest. The spongy lung he pushed away, and there, under his fingers, like a dead fish in a wicker basket, was Sister Mary Joseph Fraser's heart. He squeezed, surprised at its size, barely able to encircle it. Meanwhile, he exhorted the nurse, anesthetist, to keep pushing air into her lungs, not to stop. His right hand was buried within her thorax, but his eyes were on Sister Mary's engorged left breast, which he held out of the way with his left hand. The breast felt firm, unlike the slippery, soft part. You saw blotchy blue shadows creep into her face, a hue that her brown skin shouldn't have been capable of. Her abdomen had collapsed, its surface crinkled like an airless balloon, its two halves splayed open like a book whose spine had given way. God, God, God! Stone cried with every squeeze, calling on a God he had renounced once and didn't believe in. But Sister Mary believed, rising before dawn to pray and lingering in prayer at night before she slept. Every beat of her life and each day of her calendar had been filled with God events, and no morsel of food entered her mouth without God's blessing. Make your life something beautiful for God. If Thomas Stone never understood it, he respected it, because it was the same quality she brought to the operating theater and to the textbook she'd helped him with. That was why he called out God's name now, because if there was a God, God bloody well owed his devoted servant, Sister Mary Joseph Praise, a miracle. Otherwise, God was the shameless fraud Stone had always found him to be. If you want me to believe, God, I'll give you another chance.
So we know what happens. She does die, of course. And the twins live.
That's what he was doing, was helping anything.
He was, he was not. No. And the whole novel is the resolution of that. Hema rejects him, does not forgive him until much, much later. The boys grow up with this idea that their father abused their mother, basically, and then deserted them. And the rest of the novel is sort of the reconciliation of those ideas. There's lots of story that happens. There's lots of events that happen. But let's talk a little bit about what do you think, if you've read this, what do you think is the idea that we're supposed to be thinking about? Or what's the point of all this horror and controversy and, you know, family angst? What's the point of it? What story is he trying to tell us, do you think?
Are the boys you mentioned, are they the twins?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And they're Marion, which is, we always think it's a woman's name, but he was named after a famous surgeon who kind of revolutionized obstetric surgery. And then Shiva, which is the Hindu god that Hema looks to, and that's who she calls upon when she's delivering them. And Shiva is often seen as a god of destruction, but in her case, she depends on that. And it's a god that she depends on very much and doesn't see as just destruction, but also of strength and good fortune. So thank you. So the remainder of the novel is about these twins, their relationship with these at missing, and also their relationship with their absent father. So what else do you remember about it, or what other themes do you think the author was trying to get to in writing this tale? Yes.
This is exactly an answer to the question, but I really love the character Gauche. He was my favorite character in all of it, and I think I told you that I heard Verghese speak, and much of it is biographical. The coming to America and being the lowest, how Marion is so excited he gets a job,
Yeah, just a terrible. Our Lady of Perpetual Succor.
Yeah. And his own, that he would come that way and get the lowest paying and everything that he knows at the standard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and he loves being a doctor. He loves it. And there's a lot of praise of medicine.
Yeah.
And you know, like Shiva taking on that specialty that he did, and in spite of his other tendencies, which I think suggest Asperger's, he's an incredible physician. Everyone is that practices.
Yeah, and I am not a medical person at all, but just the way that they describe how they remember things, or the Latin names for things, or surgical procedures, I thought it was
obviously written by an expert, but someone like me could also enjoy it and appreciate it too.
You know, in fact, we were in a bookstore, a small bookstore, and there was only standing room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could only stand. And he said, the first thing he said when he got up was, as a doctor, I know exactly the impact on your heart, the ages that you are, whatever, of standing for a long period of time, so this talk will be short. So when he sees people, he sees what's going on inside you, and it's very, is very good.
Well, this is a book of relationships. Broken relationships, many broken relationships. Be it the young girl who broke with them, mm-hmm. obviously the father and the boys. His brother, his name's one thing on relationships.
Yeah.
Forgiveness.
Yeah.
Is Dr. Stone easily?
Mm-hmm.
Is Dr. Stone the father? Yeah.
There is a Dr. Stone that is the father.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we also have Dr. Stone, one of the sons, and
mm-hmm.
it should have been Dr. Stone, the other son, but, you
mm-hmm.
know.
But
he didn't get his...
But he, it's revealed that he is the father.
Yes,
he
at
is
some
father.
Point in the book.
He's also a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
He's also, you know, how did this come to be?
Right.
He's a friend, and... how that father's self and resolve.
Mm-hmm. And how did the mother deal with this? I mean, she was a nurse, so she had to have known that she was pregnant, and she chose to keep that a secret. And then that is the question, too, of what happened that year that she was between India and Addis Ababa.
At some other point, she'd been pregnant and...
She had lost a baby, you know, because she arrived and she was bleeding.
Right.
And matron... always thought, well, it might have been a menstrual period, or, you know, didn't ever ask. And there's a lot of that too, where people just don't
yeah.
ask. They just don't ask.
Which is the era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think culturally, I think that was probably pretty true too. I agree with you. Ghosh was my favorite. He was just, I loved the picture of him keeping the twins alive when they, or keeping Shiva alive when he had apnea as a newborn. He was a preemie. And he devised this system with a little bell around his ankle, and so they could pull the thread and then that, you know, get him to resume breathing, and kind of got him through that really dangerous period. Marion is the narrator, so he's the one that ends up going to the U.S. to be trained as a doctor. Shiva stays behind, and I have one reading that sort of gives you an idea of what Shiva's gifts were. You've already read, so I'm going to keep looking.
Yeah,
you're welcome. I knew you could handle it. Anyone else want to read? Oh, thank you, Barbara.
There is one last sighting at Missing, which had nothing to do with Ghosh, that I must describe because it happened during that period. It explains Shiva's life course and why it veered away from my mind. Late one morning, as Shiva and I sat on the culvert by the side of Wizards Hill, a frail, barefoot girl, no older than 12, came stiff-legged up the hill. Prematurely stooped like an old woman, she leaned heavily on her giant of a father. His muddy, patched jumpers ballooned above barefoot feet and horned toenails. He could have taken the hill in 20 strides. Instead, he took small steps to accommodate hers. They crept forward like snails, while other visitors sped up when they neared these two, as if father and daughter created an animating field. When she reached us, I understood why. An unspeakable scent of decay, putrefaction, and something else for which the words remained to be invented reached our nostrils. I saw no point in holding my breath or pinching my nose, because the foulness invaded instantly, coloring our insides like a drop of India ink in a cup of water. In the way that children understand their own, we knew her to be innocent of her terrible, overpowering odor. It was of her, but it wasn't hers. Worse than the odor, since she must have lived with it for more than a few days,
was to see in her face the knowledge of how it repulsed and revolted others. No wonder she had fallen out of the habit of looking at human faces. The world was lost to her, and she to it. When she paused to catch her breath, a slow puddle formed at her bare feet. Looking down the road, I could see the trail she left behind. I'll never forget her father's face. Under that peasant straw hat, he burned with love for his daughter and rage against the world that shunned her. His bloodshot eyes met every stare, and he even sought out those who tried not to look. He cursed their mothers and cursed the gods they worshipped. He was deranged by a scent he could have escaped. Did I say she met no one's gaze? No one's but Sheba's. A moment passed between them, a barely discernible easing of her features, as if Sheba had caressed her, reached out to comfort her. His lifted chin dipped for her, his eyes shaded to blue, and his lips set firmly together. Her lids suddenly sparkled with liquid. The father who had blasphemed his way up the hill fell silent. My brother, who once spoke with anglets and whose dance could be as complex as a honeybee's, didn't know he would dedicate his life to just such women, the outcasts of society. He would seek them at the autobus terra as they arrived from the provinces. He would pay touts to go to the furthermost villages and find them where they were hidden away, shunned by their husbands and families. He would have pamphlets distributed wherever the Coca-Cola truck went, which is to say, wherever there were paved roads, asking for these women, girls really, to come out of hiding, to come to him, so that he might cure them. He would become the world's expert. But I am ahead of my story. Sheba's understanding of the medical condition behind that odor came later. That afternoon, one of many that I spent wondering about my future, Sheba had always sprung into action. With his eyes on her, he walked to them and led father and mother to humor. I look back now and I realize that in that act, his career was already predetermined and was destined to differ vastly from mine.
Thank you.
See, I didn't really get that he had a real personality problem. He was too connected to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Sheba was. Mm-hmm. You would think about the dance and the whatever, he was too connected with other people. He was the one that went out and sought the people and the storekeepers and whatever and had the connections.
Mm-hmm.
While Marin was the expert one.
Well, Sheba was definitely saw things differently than anyone else around him. But yeah, he had really sort of psychic relationships with people or psychic connections with people. It seemed like he connected with people on a different level than most of us do.
But he connected clearly with the locals. They were not really local.
No, they weren't really.
He connected with the locals.
But he didn't see the consequences of having slept with the young lady, he had no concept of the impact that he was very focused on this one thing, but he didn't necessarily have any kind of relationship with others.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and he was so connected to his twin. I mean, they really did have that connection, but it's like he didn't take Marion's feelings into account very much. I mean, the assumption was, we're so close, I can't really hurt you. And Marion, of course, was so betrayed by Sheba going with Janet, his love, that it ruined the relationship for many, many years. So, yeah, Marion was studious and, you know, a rule follower and, you know, kind of performed in ways that you would expect. Sheba was more creative than that, or more singular about what he was going to do, I think.
Thank you for that reading, Barbara, by the way. Here's something to think about. Marion observes that in Ethiopia, patients assume that all illnesses are fatal and that death is expected. But in America, news of having a fatal illness always seems to come as a surprise. as if we took it for granted that we were immortal. What other important differences does Cutting for Stone reveal about the way illness is viewed and treated in Ethiopia and in the United States? To what extent are these differences reflected in the split between poor hospitals, like the one in the Bronx where Marion works, and the rich hospitals, like the one in Boston where his father works? So how do we look at illness in, you know, we have a pretty dramatic comparison between the U.S. and Ethiopia, where people, you know they're going to die, or aren't surprised if a child dies. You know, they're sad, of course, but, and then the way that we, when he goes to the United States and is trained, his father is also there too. I mean, what are those differences about illness, the way that we think about illness, the way we treat illness even?
Is it a matter of resource? I mean, there's a real point that the hospital may do with, you know, two sticks and a string to do practically anything. Mm-hmm. And so what was done could be done, but there wasn't extraordinary technology. Mm-hmm. And that's not particularly true here. Mm-hmm. If you pay enough, you can get what you need.
And from what I remember, this condition that you were just reading about, the women, was it anyone here a medical person, was it fistula or something? And it was a problem with the bladder, right?
There's too much tearing because the girls have had the babies when they're too young, their pelvis isn't large enough, and so there's all kinds of ripping and tearing of the bladder that doesn't just continue on tearing.
Yeah, so there's this leakage constantly, and that's what causes the odor and infection and... Okay, so that's the kind of thing that wouldn't happen here, right? I mean, we don't usually 12-year-olds haven't had a baby. And if someone did have that condition, how would it be addressed here? We would
surgery.
We have surgical, you know, and
be repaired right away.
Just from pregnancy.
Yes. Okay, and because I got some great impression that some of these girls had intercourse too young as well.
Well, that's because they're even currently they're at 5 and 6, they are sold into household slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And repeating their course and then pregnancy by the time they were 12, they had so much trauma that they no longer function. So they have these fistula clinics there now.
Mm-hmm.
And the part of that clinic is also giving them new clothes and a new sense of hope.
Is there any practice of genital mutilation in Ethiopia as well?
Yes. And another sad thing, even with the little boys, when I was there in 2001, there were families that were purposely poking the children's eyes with pins so they would be blinded, so that they could make more babies on the street.
Mm-hmm.
They were murdered because of the AIDS families and things like that, so the relatives would get all these children.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would blind them until they could go back.
Mm-hmm.
So
how did you, so you've been to Ethiopia, how did this novel resonate for you?
I didn't read it yet, I wanted to read it. I just didn't know about Ethiopia, but that's why people later.
I hope we haven't ruined it for you now.
No, I didn't realize it was a book study, so
mm-hmm.
I'm really sorry.
No, I'm very glad you did.
I want to read it.
I would be really interested to hear how you think it depicts the, you know, an earlier time frame than when you were there. But, you know, I mean, just the vibe and the feeling of if it's a true, you know.
And again, I don't know the setting, but, I mean, it takes place in Ethiopia?
Yeah, in Addis Ababa.
In Addis Ababa? Addis Ababa is a place where I have never seen so many broken people. Arms and limbs just twisted on the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
There was a factory near where we were, the Kaniyesu Seminary, that was just for handicapped workers, and there were people that couldn't walk, and they had wheels strapped to their knees so that they could scoot
mm-hmm.
to work. Leprosy. And it was a culture where the men did not work.
they would be sitting and chewing the chai leaves, their special little magic leaves, while the women worked. Mm-hmm. And they would work for 50 cents a day, and they were building boats. And then they'd still go home and take care of the
So what do you do with that?
Well, it's interesting that Stone went from that to the sophisticated hospital. But when he left Ethiopia.
Thomas Stone?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That he left everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he wanted to put it all behind him. I mean, he didn't acknowledge his sons, and he didn't even want to really acknowledge his role in all of that. And so, you know, he kind of got as far away as he could and immersed himself in a different
way. I think, in a lot of ways, did this she get pregnant when he was real sick? There was something strange about the...
There's something about it. They were,
yes, there was something, and I'm not really sure he...
I don't think he knew.
Understood. These were his children.
Yeah, I think there was it was an episode where he was sick or very... He would go on those benders where he was very drunk.
Right, right.
And so I think he honestly did not know. He didn't know
she was pregnant, mm-hmm. and he didn't know they were his.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think he must have known they were his. No, once he became rational.
Yeah. But it was such a shock.
He was not rational when...
And that's what they say when the babies are born. I mean, everyone just stands there. I mean, it's just, you know,
and then,
incomprehensible.
And then they wanted him to have anything. She was always afraid he'd come back to take the baby's away.
Mm-hmm. Hemo is very protective.
And so she didn't want him to acknowledge the babies.
Yeah, she really didn't. And she said to him, this is your last chance. You know, name
wow.
these babies, acknowledge them, or we're through with you, you know, in the heat of the horrible day. And, you know, he took her at his word, you know, pretty much, and just got out.
So does Hema raise the baby?
Yes.
Hema, and then she marries Ghosh, who, you know, they sort of were friends and, you know, kind of gone back and forth, and then they realize they really love each other and have a very happy home, you know, and raise the boys together. I would say. Others, would you agree with that? Yeah. Here's another question. What does Cutting for Stone reveal about the emotional lives of doctors? Contrast the attitudes of Hema, Ghosh, Marion, Shiva, and Thomas Stone toward their work. What draws them to the practice of medicine?
I think Hema and Stone had some similarities in their culture. It was until she had the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, she didn't have the boys, but
mm-hmm.
it was, she was very focused on her too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you don't become a surgeon because you're lazy, right?
Well,
I mean,
no.
you
well,
become.
That's true. I'm saying
we
that
hope.
He was equally focused as
mm-hmm.
he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the twins hadn't come into her life, that would have been her life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not much different from this in some ways.
That's true. What? So they looked at medicine as, you know, sort of their own, their passion. It was their expression of their
everything.
Yeah. And they were saving lives. They were obviously helping people. What about Ghosh in comparison to that? Or the twins that ended up also being doctors?
It was not Ghosh's entire life.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, too, that he's not a surgeon. He's more of a diagnostician. He's very, very good at looking at people, looking at signs, looking at skin lesions. You know, he's very good at diagnosing things. Had a very fine mind. But I thought there were so many things that were so interesting about how they'd look at someone's, you know, color or their eyes, or they'd look, you know, notice the palms of their hands. And, you know, I'm sure there are doctors still do those things. We just don't know. But, you know, you just always figure they're going to run a test. Whenever you see a doctor, they're going to draw blood and run a test. But they didn't have those sorts of things, you know, or just, you know, shaking someone's hand and checking their pulse and, you know, all those really, they said Ghosh had, it was like perfect pitch. He could tell someone's pulse rate without having to look at a watch. You know, he was very gifted that way. So what about the differences between Marion and Shiva? How did they look at, we've kind of heard about Shiva, his approach to medicine. He was singular. You know, I think the Asperger's thing in that way has some validity, I think, because he was singular, you know, just that was the one thing he was going to do. That was the one thing he'd become an expert on. That was his obsession. What about Marion in comparison as a surgeon and as a physician?
I think
doesn't stand out for me when I'm thinking that. Mm-hmm. It's the one, I know, it, of course he became the doctor, but I don't know. There's so much more about Geta and
Janet.
Janet and his own journey. Mm-hmm. It's almost like being a doctor was a side story for him. But not true of the rest of them. Mm-hmm. The rest of them, their practice of medicine is central.
And their identity with that. Well, I have one last little thing to read, just to help you think about the title, for one thing. Although it's also a play on the surname of the characters, the title Cutting for Stone comes from a line in the Hippocratic Oath. I will not cut for stone, even for patients in whom the disease is manifest. I will leave this operation to be performed by practitioners, specialists in this art. Verghese has said that this line comes from ancient times when bladder stones were epidemic and painful. There are itinerant stone cutters, lithologists, who would cut into either the bladder or the perineum and get the stone out, but because they cleaned the knife by wiping the knife on their blood-stiffened surgical aprons, patients usually died of infection the next day. So how does that line resonate for the doctors of this novel? They're cutting for stone. It's kind of a, you know, they...
I asked him that question. Mm-hmm. He said that he just likes the way it sounds. and I also asked him, why did he choose that the picture, the St. Teresa picture?
Uh-huh.
Which, I went and looked at the picture. It doesn't look remarkable to me. Mm-hmm. And he said he just likes the picture. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just strange. Those two things are so, you know, when you're looking for meaning in a book, those seem like two things that would just, you just want to mm-hmm. cut to the heart of it. Mm-hmm. He said, I love the way it sounded. And he said, I realized I wanted to write a book. And I thought, when I write a book, I'm going to call it Cutting for Stone. And Stone was not the name of the character at first.
Oh.
It came to him later. He had a name for that too. And the picture was just something he liked.
Very interesting. The ecstasy of St. Teresa, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think we actually saw last time in Rome. Yeah.
Was it remarkable in Rome?
You know, you see like 5 million
David.
Remarkable scales.
Not like David.
Yeah.
David would blow you away, but it was.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful.
But
is it in Florence?
It was in
no,
Rome.
In Rome.
In a kind of odd little church. I mean,
yeah.
Little church, but you know, like there's like an office and then a church and then a coffee shop, and so you kind of have to go around the corner and go up there, and it was, you know, it's very beautiful, but it's, you know, kind of dark in there, and
the Pieta would be more powerful than mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, behind the glass.
Yeah.
Well, tomorrow we're up for The Sparrow, which is, again, about Jesuits in outer space. So make sure that you come. We're meeting at 4:15 tomorrow. And then our last session on Friday is a book about aging, and it's got a lot of humor as well. I'm happy to report. So if you haven't read Simon's Night, I hope you still come on Friday, because I think it's a winner. It's a great book. And we're meeting at 11:15 on Friday. So thanks to everybody for coming and for participating. I've had a lot of people say they couldn't finish this book, so I'm glad that some of you that finished it came for this session too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.